Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today, I am delighted to be talking with several people who are here in the cafe and joining us by phone about the Western Climate Initiative. Sandra Ely is the Environment and Energy Policy Coordinator for the New Mexico Environment Department, and Jim Norton is the Director of the Environmental Protection Division at the New Mexico Environment Department, and he's the chair of the Western Climate Initiative Reporting Committee. We'll find out what all that means in just a few minutes. Sarah Cottrell is the Energy and Environment Policy Advisor for Governor Richardson, and joining us by phone, David Tunderman, who's an environmental lawyer with Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer in Salt Lake City, and he's a fellow in the American College of Environmental Lawyers and is also involved in the Western Climate Initiative. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have all of you here. So, first of all, let's talk about why it's important to discuss climate change in the first place, namely the dangers to our state, our country, and our world if we don't deal with it.
Well, we are especially at risk here in New Mexico because of the effects of climate change on our water supply. Obviously, with hotter temperatures, that's going to cause and is already causing reduced snowpack in the mountains. And then, of course, when that snowpack melts, it comes off quicker, and there's less water available in our rivers and streams later in the season. We're also going to experience, and already are, more forest fires, more extreme weather conditions, and that means more droughts and floods. We've already seen significant floods just recently in southern New Mexico, in Hatch, and in Ruidoso, and serious problems for the ecology of our, especially of our mountains in New Mexico. So we're really vulnerable here in New Mexico. A lot of people think often that the biggest effects will be the result of rising sea levels for our coastal areas, but I think here in New Mexico, we're especially vulnerable to climate change.
As probably many of our listeners are aware, the rest of the world, to some extent, has kind of been ahead of the United States in dealing with climate change. What are some of the international initiatives, and what has or has not been the United States' participation in them?
So international action on climate change dates all the way back to 1992 to the Earth Summit in Brazil and Rio de Janeiro. And the U.S. became a signatory to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change at that time with the goal of stabilizing greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. 5 years later, they negotiated the Kyoto Treaty in Japan. The U.S. took on binding greenhouse gas reduction targets. And then the wheels kind of came off. And when President Bush became president, he withdrew the United States from the Kyoto Treaty, and we really haven't seen any progress at the national level since. Congress has debated some bills, but we haven't seen anything pass either chamber of commerce of Congress yet, and we haven't seen a national program.
And a new verb was invented, the verb unsign, as in to unsign a treaty.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, they basically said that they would continue to negotiate on the framework convention itself, but that we would not commit to our Kyoto target.
So, on a national level, what, again, has and hasn't been done in terms of, I mean, the last couple of years, there has been some movement on climate change.
Certainly the debate has moved forward. Massachusetts versus EPA is an important Supreme Court case that established that greenhouse gases are air pollutants subject to regulation under existing law. And President Obama supports cap-and-trade legislation and has appointed a number of great people to his administration who understand the need for climate action. So we're optimistic, but we're not sure yet how quickly they'll move in this new administration on climate change.
So as a result of the non-action or sluggish action in the United States, some regional initiatives have come into being, and one of them is the Western Climate Initiative, but that has some precedents, including here in New Mexico. Governor Richardson signed an executive order about, what, 4 years ago, was it?
That's right. Governor Richardson really kicked off the state's work on climate change in 2005 when he signed an executive order. And there were several things in the executive order that he directed us at the Environment Department to do. One was that he set aggressive emission reduction targets for us here in the state, and then formed an advisory group to make recommendations about how to meet those aggressive emission reduction targets. He also directed us to do a study of what the effects of climate change are in New Mexico that we talked about a few moments ago, and then also directed us to prepare an inventory of the emissions so that we know where those emissions come from in New Mexico.
So what is the history of the Western Climate Initiative?
So as we talked about, in the absence of federal leadership on climate change, states are taking the lead, and ultimately we all recognize that we need a national program, but we're not willing to wait to see what's going to happen because the science of climate change is irrefutable. So in February of 2007, Governor Richardson and four Western governors signed an MOU creating the Western Climate Initiative.
Signed a what?
A memorandum of understanding, creating the WCI, the Western Climate Initiative. And the main objective of this initiative is to develop a Western regional greenhouse gas cap and trade program to help meet a regional goal of reducing emissions by 15% below 2005 levels by 2020.
15% below 2005 levels. That's significant.
It is significant. It's a good start. Some would argue that it's not as much as we need according to the science, but we have to start. We have to start making reductions, and we'll certainly need to ratchet that number down over time. But we feel like this is a good starting point.
So are there other programs in the United States of this kind? The Western is one thing. There are also Midwestern programs and so on?
Yeah, that's right. We aren't alone in this effort. In the absence of federal action, many of the states have moved forward to look at cap-and-trade programs. There's the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the Northeast that consists of 10 Northeast states, and their program is really just electric utilities. But they're ahead of us because they've already started. They started their auction last fall. They've started their program in January, and so we're looking to their experience, learning from their experience as we move forward with the WCI. There is also the Midwestern states, too, under the Midwestern Corps that have started a program, too. But they don't actually have a program up and running. They're in the development phase, and they're looking to us, to see what happens with the WCI, I think, before they get going.
The WCI is the Western Climate Initiative, about which we are talking this whole hour today on the Radio Cafe. So it's an interesting combination of executive and legislative action that is going on here, and one that really requires, I think, more understanding on the part of citizens than maybe we have. So the governor says, yes, we are signing on to the WCI, but then legislators who are voted in by us and who are, in theory, guided by us have to actually make the details of it happen, and there is legislation right now pending in front of this legislature.
That's correct. The proposal is called the New Mexico Global Warming Solutions Act. It's sponsored by Representative Ben Rotifer, and it provides the state's Environmental Improvement Board with the added authority to fully implement the Western Climate Initiative program. Under the proposal, the EIB is what we call this board, could establish a greenhouse gas trading program, including the auctioning of emission allowances and the establishment of an offset program and recognition of early emission reductions. It does put constraints on the EIB in establishing the program, and it asks them to take a look at things like the costs and benefits to the state of the program, considering impacts on low-income communities, competitive issues, and the size of the allowance market, that kind of thing. But it provides them the authority to move forward and take the time we need to implement a solid program.
So in the absence of legislative action, the Western Climate Initiative, it can't do anything.
Well, that's not completely true. The states and provinces, there are 11 of them that are part of the Western Climate Initiative, have a variety of different existing underlying laws. And for us here in New Mexico, the legislature has already granted to the Environmental Improvement Board the authority to regulate air pollution. And global warming pollution is a form of air pollution. So if it's a smokestack, here in New Mexico that's emitting pollution, the legislature has already granted authority to the EIB to do those regulations. However, if the source of pollution is in another state and then it's imported into New Mexico, for example, through a power line or something of that nature, then there is additional legislative authority needed. Also, the WCI is recommending a trading program, including auctioning of allowances to emit greenhouse gases, and that's another thing that there's legislative authority needed for. So the Global Warming Solutions Act that Sarah mentioned a minute ago will be addressing those areas where the existing legislative authority doesn't exist yet. And there are quite different situations among all the different 11 partners. For example, California has a very broad bill that grants the authority in effect for all of this already. Some of the Canadian provinces have the same, and then other states are in different situations.
Who's in the Western Climate Initiative?
Well, there are, you know, there were originally just the five states, and since that time, since California first joined, Oregon, Washington, Arizona, New Mexico first founded it, the states of Utah and Montana have joined, and four Canadian provinces, British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec.
Oddly, Quebec is not really in the West.
That's right. Well, and neither is Ontario. It's right. Pretty far east. And right. And Manitoba.
Right.
Those four Canadian provinces represent 80% of the economy in Canada. So their participation is significant. And the seven states represent about 20% of the U.S. economy. So that's significant as well.
So let's talk to David Tunderman for a moment, who is joining us from Utah, one of the states that signed on to the Western Climate Initiative. What are the advantages and disadvantages to having a regional climate initiative?
Well, I think the states and the regions have historically been good policy laboratories to develop implement environmental programs, and they provide essential resources to implementing environmental programs, and that's been true in other environmental areas such as clean air and clean water and so forth. But at the same time, there's a real advantage to national consistency to avoid anti-competitive cross-border and interstate impacts, and it appears that federal legislation is coming and is coming quickly. I think Senator Boxer has promised Senate action prior to the Copenhagen conference next December. And as Jim pointed out, many of the Western states need additional legislation to move forward to implementation, so that while the three regional initiatives are terrific policy laboratories, and I think ought to continue to develop programs because it will give those states and regions a head start in implementing federal legislation. Yet still, the advantages of national consistency seem to argue for pushing ahead with federal legislation and then using the regional programs as a head start on implementing the new federal program, which is certainly coming.
And it does seem that there's one great big loophole, namely, for example, let's say somebody wants to put a coal plant in New Mexico. We have climate legislation that makes it economically less favorable for them to do that. Then they go over the border, they do it in Texas, that they're not part of it, and they import energy from there. We haven't solved anything.
Yeah, that's right. Leakage is an issue that has to be addressed, that you will get whether it's a regional program or a national program, because you can have international leakage, and it's something we need to hit head on. Now, the broader the scope of the program, the more sources included, the less likely there will be leakage. And that's one reason that we want to address imported power, not just the smokestack, as Director Norton mentioned, but the importation of power into the state. So under the WCI design, and what we're seeking legislative authority for, is the ability to require the first recipient of that power as it comes into the state to hold allowances. So if you have a desert rock that gets constructed, or Four Corners that sends power into New Mexico because they're on Indian land, not in our jurisdiction, the first recipient of that power would have to hold allowances. So we will be able to address that power, and just because they're outside the state doesn't mean they won't be affected by the program.
Could you explain the concept of cap and trade and, for example, the term allowances, what that even means?
Yeah, that's right. A cap and trade really is the most economical way to address greenhouse gas emission reductions. You set your cap, but you let industry determine how they get there.
So a cap means there is a limit that in the state of New Mexico or in the region or in the world, there is X amount of greenhouse gases that may be emitted and not one bit more.
That's right. And then it declines over time, so you get those emission reductions. And you require industry to hold an allowance or a ton of carbon. An allowance is a permit to emit that ton of carbon for every ton they've emitted. This isn't new to them because they've never had to be accountable for those emissions before. They've just been able to emit them, and now they have to pay for them. So that also gets the emission reductions. But one of the really nice things about it is it lets industry decide how they get that emission reduction. It provides them more flexibility than they normally have under a command and control type scenario, which is how we regulated air pollution in the past. So we say, this is how far you got to get your emission reductions down to. They determine how they get there. And if they go beyond what's required by the law, then they can sell those allowances to somebody else. So if they can do it cheaply, they sell it to somebody who has higher abatement costs. And that's why the program is economical. It also drives innovation because industry uses their best minds to get those emission reductions because there's money associated with that. And it also creates linkages internationally, like with the REGI program or the European program.
Let's say a coal plant decides to plant 10,000 acres worth of trees in the rainforest. Do they get credit for that?
Potentially. Yeah, that's what we call an offset. An offset is an emission reduction that occurs outside of the cap sector. So since forestry is not in our program, it's outside the program. Now, there's a lot of concern about offsets. They have to be real, verifiable, they have to be permanent, they have to be enforceable, and so we're establishing a very robust offset program so that those sources outside the cap can also have incentives to reduce. In New Mexico, some of those offset programs would affect agriculture. So we've got, say, dairy waste or methane production from these dairies. If they can reduce that methane reduction, turn it into power, they'll get money for that. It'll also include landfills. If there's methane loss related to those landfills, if they capture that, then they could get money for that as well. So we're encouraging offsets. We think it's a great way to get additional emission reductions.
If I might interject here, Mary,
yes.
Charlotte, one of the ways to keep the costs down of a cap-and-trade system is to take Sarah's, I guess that was Sarah's point, and expand it as broadly as possible, because the larger the potential offset market, both from out-of-state and even out-of-country sources, and credits for early reduction, people who can reduce their emissions early on, the more flexibility there is in allowing offsets and early reduction credits, the lower the overall cost will be, because the company subject to the reduction can go outside and even can go to Mexico or someplace else to find cheaper ways to achieve its CO2 emissions.
How is the data collected that tells us in the first place how many tons of stuff industries are putting into the air in the first place?
Well, this is something that we here in New Mexico have been working on a lot, and then also through the Western Climate Initiative Reporting Committee. It's very important for the measurement of the emissions to be accurate, because this will be translated into costs later, and as Sandra mentioned, tradable units. So we need to know what the amount of pollution is that's being emitted from each source. And so we have developed a really quite rigorous process of measuring the emissions from each of the types of emission sources. And we have released many drafts of this overall mandatory reporting document, and it will be completed in the next month or two. And one of the things that we're also finding is very important is we have to do this the same. In other words, we can't here in New Mexico measure emissions in one way and then have industry in British Columbia measure emissions in a different way, because it can translate into millions of dollars in economic value that either benefits or harms one of the states. So we've been working together among all the 11 partners to make the reporting system harmonized, and so we, each state and province, will then adopt as regulations those reporting requirements, and we'll know that a ton is a ton in each of the states and provinces that are part of WCI.
And who goes around? What authority is it that goes around with their devices and measures carbon coming out of smokestacks or whatever?
Well, there are many different ways that this happens. For example, in a utility, they can actually measure the number of tons coming out of a smokestack. It's more complicated in some factory settings and in some other situations where the emissions are more difficult to quantify. But we're using the best available methods that can be used in order to do that.
David, I think that part of the concern of your clients, and you have clients who are extractive industries, mining and oil and gas, and people who have really traditionally tried to block environmental legislation of all kinds. How are they dealing with all of this?
I think that most realistic or many realistic companies look at the Massachusetts v. EPA decision that Sarah mentioned, which points toward using the Clean Air Act as a way to regulate climate emissions, which is a very poor tool for accomplishing that. So I think realistic and practical industries realize that new federal legislation is needed because the existing laws are such a poor tool. I'd like to underscore the importance of what Jim said regarding accurate measurement, and note that for quite a number of industries and source categories, adequate methods for measuring emissions are not yet available. So there, while quite a bit of good work has been done, there remains quite a bit of good work to be done in order to develop reliable measuring techniques for these gases.
What are the industries that we're even talking about? Who in New Mexico, in the West, is really giving off the bulk of greenhouse gases?
Well, the governor did require us to do an inventory. And what we found in New Mexico is that the largest source of emissions is from electric utilities, largely the big coal plants in the state. Second for us is the oil and gas industry. There is a significant amount of carbon dioxide that's mixed in with the natural gas, in particularly in the northwest part of the state, and that CO2 is vented into the atmosphere. There are also emissions of the natural gas, which is methane, and which is a very potent greenhouse gas as well. And then the third biggest source for us in New Mexico is transportation, cars and trucks, etc. And we're a little different from nationally. Transportation nationally is the second largest source, but for us it's third because of the big emissions in the oil and gas industry.
So are we, for example, drivers part of this?
Not directly. The WCI program starts out in 2012 with the large utilities, the electric utilities, and other large sources of emissions in factories, for example. Later in 2015, the program brings in transportation fuels, but the regulation will not happen at each person's car, but rather at choke points where the transportation fuels enter commerce. So you can think of it as being like the end of a pipeline, where the gasoline is transported from the pipeline into trucks that then head off to gas stations. So that would be the point of regulation for transportation fuels, and then similarly for residential and commercial fuels. Natural gas, for example, would also be regulated at choke points, like the end of a natural gas pipeline.
So what we're talking about, the Western Climate Initiative cap-and-trade programs that would affect New Mexico and states throughout the West and Canada. What would be the penalties if, for example, an electric power plant said, well, we just aren't going to comply with this and we'll pay the penalties? In other words, what makes it, how strong do the penalties have to be for them to actually say, we're going to comply?
Well, you know, we have our standard penalty structure in New Mexico already under the Air Quality Control Act that allows us to collect $15,000 a day per violation. But we need to be consistent across the region, and that may not match up with the other provinces or states. We don't want to have weaker enforcement in one state than another. So we all agreed that to have a 3-to-1 coverage. What that means is that an entity must have sufficient allowances to cover their emissions at the end of the compliance period. If they don't, they pay 3 times the market price for every allowance or every ton they are missing. And we think that will be sufficient to get compliance. A 3-to-1 penalty is pretty good. It's what the RGGI states are doing, and it's what the WCI will be doing. Now, the states can go above and beyond that, too. I mean, there may be appropriate times to do that. If you have somebody who blatantly violates the law and continues to do so, we can, you know, ratchet it up. But the 3-to-1 is the minimum through the WCI.
Is there any kind of incentive whereby an electric utility that was about to build a coal plant would say, you know, we think we're just going to, instead of extracting coal, put solar panels over a very big sunny area?
Well, you know, we don't have incentives for a facility that's not going to be emitting, you know, a new facility.
Right.
I mean, we have incentives for, put in solar or wind or geothermal and other, say, tax credits. But in this program, if you already have an existing plant, say the San Juan plant, and they decide to reduce now rather than wait until the program starts, we will make sure that they get credit for that. That's
right.
The early reduction credits. And David mentioned that earlier. It's very important to industry because there are industries right now who are moving ahead and reducing their greenhouse gas emissions, shrinking their carbon footprint, and we want to reward that because we want that to happen. So the WCI design does account for that.
If I could add to that, in this legislative session, we've got a couple of bills, even in this tight environment, to try to provide financial incentives to companies that are going to make investments in renewable energy, especially solar, dairy, biomass, those kinds of industries. So we're trying to complement the Western Climate Initiative framework with other policies and other tax incentives and structures that help incentivize the type of investments we want to see in our state.
And hopefully the administration's new stimulus bill will provide additional incentives for investment in renewables to use as offsets or reduction credits in this program.
We're talking to Sandra Ely and Jim Norton from the New Mexico Environment Department, Sarah Cottrell from Governor Richardson's office, and David Tunderman, environmental lawyer from Utah. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR.